as we embark on this vital mission. Email your tips to wpfw.lsb.relocation@gmail.com. And thanks for all you do to nourish and sustain WPFW, building a better world one broadcast
at a time.
You'd be so
nice to come home to. You'd be so nice.
Freedom. My name is M1. I'm half of the legendary Tell It Like It Is, Everything Is Political rap duo Dead Prez. And this is WPFW, Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Before Magic's knees go permanently south for the winter.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Changing up the guard quicker than fear brings down doo-doo. Bro.
He never saw Elgin Baylor play during his day, or Oscar Robertson.
Flash the dice, roll back. The big O was jackknifing through all them bodies.
I didn't know nothing about it.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Collision. He's Chuck Modiano. I'm Dave Zirin. No Eitan Thomas this week, but we're here at your home for Jazz and Justice, 89.3 FM WPFW, trying to change this world one broadcast at a time. Chuck Modiano, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. How about yourself, DZ?
Well, I'm very excited because we have one heck of a guest coming in at 10:30 who I'm very excited to speak with. We are talking to the Sports Enterprise reporter for the Washington Post, who focuses on the intersection of gender, diversity, and how sports shape our society. Ooh, that sounds just like the Collision. He's been a guest before. He's terrific. His name is Michael Lee, and he just wrote a terrific piece coinciding with April 8th, 2024, about the 50th anniversary. And this almost slipped by without people talking about it. The 50th anniversary of Hammer and Hank Aaron hitting home run number 15, passing the record of Babe Ruth, and all the controversy, all the racism that surrounded Aaron's efforts. Michael Lee wrote a brilliant article looking at what that home run meant to people, and we're going to talk to him about it.
50 years ago, wow.
Makes you think, no doubt about it. And he hit the ball off of one Mr. Al Downing, and it was caught in the bullpen by a young pitcher named Tom House, who went on to become a very influential pitching coach. So a lot of interesting little thingamajigamas there.
And you forgot to mention that when I was growing up as a kid, I had a poster of that home run on my wall. And I know they circled the ball on this poster to show it as he's swinging. So I grew up with that poster. I could have done without those Braves uniforms, but it is what it is. It was an iconic moment.
How could I forget that you had a poster?
I don't think I told you. I don't think I told you, because if I did, you would have certainly have mentioned it in the lineup.
I had simply no idea you had a poster, but that's actually awesome.
Yeah.
That you had a poster that's very cool. And of course, the iconic image of two young, white, sort of hippie looking guys running out onto the field to shake Henry Aaron's hand as he rounded the bases. And given some of the death threats that had surrounded Henry Aaron, there were some people ready to jump onto the field and give those guys the worst experience of their lives.
That's right.
So a lot of drama around that home run. And, you know, another thing people don't talk about with it is that it was April, which means he almost broke it in 1973, did not, and then had to spend the whole offseason thinking about it.
Thinking about it amidst death threats.
Amidst death threats, not just to him, but to his family. So talking to Michael Lee about that, I think, is going to be an education for all of us. But, Chuck, before we get down to the bottom of the hour, I always like doing this when you're on the show. And before we start talking about some serious stuff here, like the NCAA women's and men's finals and what it all meant, I'm talking basketball, of course. I did want to ask you, what's happening in these streets these days?
Yeah, so I haven't covered a lot of protests, but they're happening all over the country, really. I think I want to point to Chicago today. You see these mass sit-ins in the streets. There are disruptions just about every other day. It hasn't slowed. So we see it in Chicago. Obviously, D.C.'s shown up. Obviously, New York City's shown up. L.A. has shown up. And all around the country. And the other thing I wanted to mention, because I think I heard at the beginning of this broadcast, it was Katia's voice. I want to say R.I.P. Dory Ladner, a civil rights icon who just gave so much to D.C. I had the pleasure and honor to meet her in 2014, 2015, when she was dispensing wisdom to activists who were working with Ferguson, working around Baltimore Uprising, working around police, and sharing the wisdom of the 60s and how it would be applicable today. And the last thing I want to say, you probably don't know if you remember this, but I have a picture. I was doing digging, and I found a picture of you, Ms. Dory Ladner, and John Carlos, that I took at a DC sports panel. So I have that for you, DZ, and I think you'll cherish that picture.
Well, I certainly will. Dory Ladner was always a supporter of our program here, The Collision, in addition to being a supporter of any and all social movements that spoke to the best angels of our nature. As I've been doing research for this book that I'm writing about Howard Zinn and the historian, and going through the years of SNCC, Dory Ladner's name is all over the history.
Yeah.
And it's important because we speak about people sometimes being forgotten by history. But in this case, I think we're talking about we need to learn the history.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And
yeah.
We learn the history. We're going to learn about Dory Ladner because she was a towering figure in the most important social movement of the 20th century. She was a grassroots fighter, put her life at risk, and we're all a little bit more free because of her efforts.
Well, I think you're right. And in general, you know, you mentioned SNCC. SNCC has always sort of taken a back seat historically when they did so much work. And I don't want to minimize anyone, but we remember the mobilizers tend to be the male mobilizers, Martin Luther King, who was indispensable to the civil rights movement. But they're mobilizers and they're organizers, and you can't have one without the other. So when you're talking about SNCC, when you're talking about a Dory Ladner, or you're talking about an Ella Baker, who never really got the credit to this day, that we know, activists know, that work has to happen on the ground. You have to organize everything on the ground, the sit-ins and what was happening across the country that happened like wildfire. That takes organization. So I just want to shout that out. So I'm really happy that we're talking about Dory Ladner right now.
And of
her incredible efforts.
Dory Ladner's immortal, amazing sister, Joyce Ladner, who's such a supporter of WPFW. Love to Joyce Ladner as she goes through this difficult period. Just so much respect for the Ladner family. And, you know, we have to remember, too, thanks to the wisdom of folks like Ella Baker, we are talking about a movement in SNCC that really was a bottom-up movement, where people like Ella Baker and Howard Zinn really pressed upon the young people that it needed to be run by them. And the young people, people like Bob Moses, people like Dory Ladner, they understood the power of that, of this being a different generation leading this struggle. I could put the name Marion Barry on that too.
That's right. You got to start there.
Absolutely. But there's so many names we could put on, names that, if you know the history, are just immortal. Lawrence Guyot, another person who was in DC for so many years and was such a mentor to so many of us. Just so much love and respect for the SNCC generation, and it's important that we raise all respect to them. And I think we're going to do so a little later in the show as well, as we say goodbye. But first, Chuck, I haven't even spoken to you about this. Did you see the women's NCAA tournament? Did you see the men's NCAA tournament? And the political implications about the fact that the women's tournament completely outpaced the men's tournament in terms of viewership. 24 million people at the peak were watching the women's NCAA college basketball final between the Iowa Hawkeyes and the South Carolina Gamecocks. South Carolina finishes an unbeaten season led by the Hall of Famer, the immortal Dawn Staley, over Iowa, led by Caitlin Clark, who's become such a media sensation. And it's going to be very interesting to see what happens going forward. If this is a permanent state of affairs, which I think it very well could be, we could be looking at a pivot towards a different level of popularity in women's sports generally, and women's basketball most specifically. But it was quite something to see the March Madness extend to the women's realm. And let's remember that 24 million number for watch that higher than the World Series, higher than the NBA Finals, higher than every single Thursday night NFL game, and quite a few games on Monday night as well. I mean, you're talking about a social phenomenon that took place in women's college basketball. And honestly, it was amazing to have a front row seat to it these last few weeks. I mean, during these terrible times, terrible on so many fronts, I mean, that was not just a sight of escape for me, but a sight of satisfaction.
I agree. Great satisfaction. I loved it. And I'm going to say I've watched less sports this year than ever before. And, you know, we have a sports show, and a lot of that has to do with what's going on in Gaza. And I've sort of thrown myself into those protests in a way that just sometimes makes sports difficult for me. This was so much more than sports. And yes, I watched the women's game. I didn't watch all the men's games, but I watched the women's game because of what you just mentioned. I see a phenomena taking place. Talk about Caitlin Clark, and she's the truth. There's no doubt about it. She's the truth. And when you hear critique, it's not really about her. It's about some of the reaction to her versus maybe a more racist reaction of how someone might look at Angel Reese's trash talking versus her. So people mistake that we're trash talking Caitlin Clark. No, we're saying I'm going to enjoy Caitlin Clark. She's the truth. She led the league in scoring. She's the number one scorer in history. But what people forget, she's the number three in assists in history. And I believe it's that latter part is what's going to make her transition to the NBA work so well, because she's just an incredible passer. And now she's going to pass to Leah Boston and Alyssa Smith. She has people who are going to finish in a way that maybe they wouldn't at Iowa. So I think it's wonderful. And many people watch because she's great. Other people watch because she's white. We have to be honest about that fact that she's bringing in white people. But if they're here now and you got more viewers now, how can we leverage that? And will that be leveraged into women's sports? And I think it will. And the last thing I sort of want to say, you got to talk about South Carolina. Dawn Staley, a legend. It was an honor for me to see her go into the Hall of Fame years ago when I went to the Hall of Fame. So people need to choose a Hall of Famer, and she's going to end up entering as a Hall of Fame coach. And what I think I love about Dawn Staley is that they basically have two starting teams that could almost make the Sweet 16 their depth. And the reason they have the depth is where other teams, people will go into the transfer portal so they could be the star. She convinces her players, wait your turn. They do have NIL, but it's more of as a team. Wait your turn and you will get that notice. So you could be a Cardoso behind Aaliyah Boston and not transfer to be a star. You wait your turn, you'll show up this year, and then you'll go top five in the NBA draft. So she has taken a collection of individuals, turned them into a team, and convinced them that to stay here, your time will come. And I think that's a beautiful thing when you're talking about the depth of South Carolina.
Yeah, absolutely. Great observations all around. With Caitlin Clark, it's kind of a yes and. Because, well, let's be clear about this. There are two criticisms of Caitlin Clark, one which I think is absurd, one which I think we need to have a, shall we say, critical race analysis of. The absurd critique comes from people like somebody whose, you know, picture was once on my wall in my study where I do my work. And that's, so I hate having to bring out the critiques, but people like Diana Taurasi, that generation of players, people who tend to be at the tail end of their WNBA careers, people, who tend to be connected to UConn, have this perspective on Caitlin Clark of, well, she's overrated. She's not that good. We have better players. Paige Beckers is a better player. And I love Paige Beckers, but I think that's a little bit silly to say. This kind of pushing her down, Caitlin Clark, instead of lifting her up. And I think that this is a case where it's very important for this generation of players to lift Caitlin Clark up and be like, yeah, it's great she's coming to the WNBA. It's great she's going to be on the Indiana Fever playing with Aaliyah Boston. It's great for the league. It's great for the sport. We're going to get more eyeballs on the sport. We have a great league in the WNBA. This is a chance to showcase it to more people. That's what I'd like to be said. I mean, and if you think about it, like in the NBA, Victor Wembanyama comes in, and it's not like people are like, yeah, he's terrible. You know, I mean, it's like, no, this is someone who's going to expand the audience because he's that remarkable and that different. So that critique bothers me. And you heard it a lot if people were watching the Sue Bird, Diana Taurasi broadcast of the finals, which is like an ESPN2 broadcast that they were doing with those two UConn legends speaking. I didn't like that. That rubbed me wrong.
I have a different opinion.
My view, though, let me just finish this, though. The analysis that I think needs to be said is sort of a yes and analysis. Like, let's be honest about it. That Iowa team was an overwhelmingly white team, and going up against an overwhelmingly team of black players at South Carolina. And because we live in such a racist society, and because I think social media is set up, not coincidentally, by some of the richest, most backwards people on the face of the planet, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg. I mean, it pushes us against each other. And racialized comments are strongly highlighted. Racism is strongly highlighted. And I do feel like these algorithms are designed to turn us against one another. But I also think, you know, this is America. We don't need that much help to be turned against one another. And I think that is something we need to have the approach to me of a yes and. Like, yes, more eyeballs are on this with Caitlin Clark because, you know, she's white, telegenic, everything that America seems to love. But also, we're talking about somebody who averaged over 26 feet on her three-pointers, which
right.
Men's and women's. That's bonkers, given the number of threes she took. To average 26 feet on made threes is astounding. And as you said, to score more points than Pete Maravich, to be the kind of passer that she is, to be must-see TV. All of that to me was extremely legit, although the proof is going to be in the pudding next year, my friend, because USC has a player named Juju Watkins, who is every bit as exciting as Caitlin Clark. A different kind of game, but wow. When you watch Juju Watkins, you're watching somebody with some, as we say, with some serious wiggle in terms of her ability to get open and play the game. And I think that we'll see. If the audience stays to see Juju Watkins, it's going to say one thing about America. And if it doesn't, it's going to say another.
That's right. I think they will stay for Juju Watkins. They will stay for Paige Beckers. They will stay for South Carolina coming back maybe for another run. I think you're going to see higher ratings. They may not be what it is now with the Caitlin Clark phenomena, but I think you make a good point. I'm going to tell you what I really agree and where I part a little bit with something you said. Well, where I agree is, yes, race is a central factor. It did have this, you know, this white, black, you know, dichotomy. So I often do get mad at not the fans who join because she's great, but the fans who join that if she was still balling the same way but were a black baller, they wouldn't join. And then that contingent exists. And we have to be honest about that contingent. It exists. Or, you know, I have the space that I think she's the truth. I love her passing. I think her pass, her assist's going to go up when she goes to WNBA because she has better people to go to and her points will go down. But when you're the best scorer on the court with your teammates, and let's be honest, she didn't have a great teammates. So if she went to a UConn or something like that, she'd have much better teammates. So to go back to back, I think it's similar as a phenomenon when you talk about back-to-back titles, but losing. Well, the Fab Five did that 30 years ago, and they live on today as a cultural phenomena, even though they didn't win both those finals. So I think you're gonna that this might live on as well. Does it bother me that when I see people in my timeline who are racialized, who are racializing it and weren't into women's sports, and tell me, try to juxtapose Caitlin Clark for Angel Reese and how they comport themselves? Well, I got to remind them that Caitlin Clark talks a lot of smack. I got to remind them that Raven Johnson last year, who was about to shoot, she pulled feet away, about 10 feet away and waved her off, dismissed her, which I found disrespectful, but I understand it's within the game. And so things that Angel Reese would have done that people say, particularly white men, are saying this is disrespectful. I could show you a tape of Caitlin Clark doing it, and I need to question why you don't find that disrespectful. I need to interrogate you if you have a double standard for Angel Reese. So I think we could do both those things, celebrate Caitlin Clark and make sure people aren't having a double standard. And I got one more thing. I know I'm filibustering a little bit. So can I give you one more thing, DZ?
Heck to the yes.
Okay, here's my disagreement. And I saw the Diana Taurasi quote. I saw the quotes that they said people were hating. And I first, oh, man, you know, I wish you didn't say that. But then I listened to the whole clip. And you know, with the question that was asked was, how do you feel about, you know, rookies coming in today? It wasn't limited to Caitlin Clark. And she said, oh, well, you know what? They're in for a rude awakening. And that ended up being a quote. Caitlin Clark's in for a rude awakening. You saw that quote everywhere. But that's not really what she said. She said, all rookies are in it. I went through it, too. There's an adjustment period. That doesn't mean you're not going to be great, but there's an adjustment period. And when you listen to the whole quote, I didn't hear hate at all. I heard her talking about an adjustment period that most rookies make, and how long or how not long it is, you know, up for debate. The other, I heard a couple of other critiques that one was on Breonna Stewart. They asked her and they said, does it mean if you don't win a championship, can you be the greatest? Now they're asking someone, let's be clear, Breonna Stewart won 4 championships in 4 years and was the most outstanding player all 4 years. So yeah, you know, she's done some things. Now she's got way better teammates. Now she said, I think you do need a championship. Now, while I personally disagree, let's not act like for the last 20 years or 30 years, media hasn't been making championships a prerequisite for greatness. I get this from media, and I'm on the other end. And when I try to defend LeBron before he left Cleveland, they say, no, you need a championship. So I guess what I'm saying is that She's not using anything that you don't see in media every single day within the framework of male sports. And on some level, the mildest critique, and I wouldn't call it hate. I would say the mildest critique, I feel, got more of a backlash when I feel like I've been watching these critiques. I mean, in other words, she wasn't getting death threats like Angel Reese was. She wasn't getting 20 years of Skip Bayless hate and all the other people like LeBron has been, no matter what he does. So in the scheme of hate, I think there might be a little sensitivity. I do believe there's room for critique as anyone else would. So that's my somewhat differing opinion.
You see, I differ on that because I think I always hear from players that ring culture, other than Shaq, I hear from players that ring culture is part of the problem.
It is.
And I think that Breonna Stewart, given the leadership role that she's played, both as a player and politically in some cases over the years, could have done well to say, like, look, do you have to win a championship? Look, you know, that's not how you judge things in a team sport, you know? And a little bit of self-consciousness about the fact that those UConn teams that Breonna Stewart was on were absolutely stacked. And Caitlin Clark's team, not so much. I mean, you keep mentioning correctly that she's going to get assists more in the WNBA. Why is that? Because her teammates sold on a bunch of those assists as the
kid. Oh, yeah. No question. And Aaliyah Boston is finishing those layups that weren't happening at the final.
Yes. And all of that is important as part. And you know, and I'm going to say this too, in an effort to be honest with you, the listener, there is something that I've always found about Gino Auriemma to be bothersome at UConn, and the cult of UConn, which exists in basketball, both women's and men's, which can come off as particularly harsh, obnoxious, denigration. I don't like that because I think we have to be lifting people up, not pushing them down. And I mean, if you heard recently, like Kyrie Irving's comments on Luka Doncic, just beautiful comments, and or Mike Malone's comments about Nikola Jokic, two things that are both in the news today, talking about them for why they should be MVP. Like Mike Malone and Kyrie Irving both made a point to praise the other people who are at the top of the mountain. And then they made a point to say, but this is the case I want to make for my guy. And I guess that yes and is what I'm looking for. Now, maybe I'm looking for it. You're right, because I'm holding all of this to a higher standard. But I'm not holding it to a higher standard because of gender. I want to be clear about that, at least consciously in my mind. Of course, subconsciously, that can always be an issue. I'm holding it to a higher standard because I really do believe this is a pivot point for the WNBA. And it's kind of like I've been a supporter of the league, a watcher of the league, a fan of the league for some time. And I feel like this is an all hands on deck moment where it's like we have the attention of the country. Let's leverage that as hardcore as we can. And well, so I want to see that. Now, one could also make the case that, you know, these comments and these rivalries can also stoke interest.
Bam.
There is truth to that as well, and I respect that perspective very much. I would approach it a different way, but hey, who the heck am I? And I want to say one last thing, but you go ahead.
No, say your last thing, DZ.
My one last thing, and this is just some lateral thinking based on what we were talking about earlier. Without the Dory and Joyce Ladners of the world laying the groundwork for not just black empowerment, but women's empowerment in positions of leadership in the most important social movement of the 20th century, I'm not sure we're even having this discussion. That's what I wanted to say.
I think it's a great thing to say. I think it's an absolutely true thing to say. I was going to have a rebuttal, and you gave me my own rebuttal, which is does some of this controversy help? Well, let's look at it. Why was LSU South Carolina ratings huge because of the controversy last year, because Angel Reese Dare acted like men do all the time in sports, or acted like Caitlin Clark did earlier in the tournament, right? But it was unbecoming of Angel Reese, which had both gender and racial dynamics intersecting on some of that hate. Well, that rivalry informed this year. The South Carolina loss to Iowa in the Final Four last year informed the rivalry this year. So what you're seeing in women's basketball, unlike men who have the one and done and we root for cotton instead of people, back in the day we were invested in people who stayed 3-4 years. Patrick Ewing stayed 4 years. They're gone. We don't know. We don't get to know them. Now we get to know the women players. We're invested. Paige Beckers next year has a history. Juju Watkins started a history. This history helps bring people in the fold to watch it. And some of those controversial pieces, people are going to watch to say, oh, Diana Taurasi, here's what I think you said. Now let's see what she's doing. I think it all helps in the long run.
You know what? That's a great point as well. Yo, let's go to break right now. We, as promised, we've got Michael Lee on the other side. We're going to speak to him about his brilliant article in the Washington Post about the 50th anniversary of the shot heard around the world. I'm not talking about Bobby Thompson. I'm talking about Henry Aaron, 715, 50 years ago, just last week. I can't wait to talk to Michael Lee. Let's go to a break right now. All love to the great Ladner sisters, Dori Ladner, rest in ultimate power, Joyce Ladner. We're such fans of you. Let's go to break right now. We'll be back right after this with The Collision.
We're hailing from East Oakland, California, and sometimes it gets a little hectic out there. But right now, you know, we gonna up you on how we just chill.
Dial up 7 digits, call up Bridget, her man's a midget. Plus she got fringe, yo, I can dig it. Here's a 40 swigging, you know it's frigid. I got him chilling in the cooler, break out the ruler. Damn, that's the fattest dog I ever seen. The weather's heat in Cali, getting weed, it makes it feel like Maui. Now we feel the good vibrations. So many females, so much inspiration.
I get inspired by the blunts too, up front you. The bunk crew. I roam the strip for bones to pick. When I find one, an iron gun, take her home and quickly do this. Yep. I need not explain this. Nah. It plus is famous, so get the anus.
Hey, miss, who's there? I'm through there. No time to do hair. The flicks at 8, so get straight. You look great. Let's rub down.
Souls of Mischief, 93 till infinity. I know that. Dave Zirin here on The Collision with Chuck Modiano here at 89.3 FM WPFW, your home for jazz and justice, trying to change this world one broadcast at a time. On the program right now, we have the sports enterprise reporter for the Washington Post, focusing on the intersection of gender, diversity, and how sports shape our society. He wrote a banger of an article about the 50th anniversary of Henry Aaron's home run, number 715. His name is Michael Lee. Michael Lee, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you guys doing?
Man, it's great to have you on the show, man. I mean, especially after that piece you wrote.
Wonderful article. Wonderful.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, we know the basics of the story, Michael. Henry Aaron hits number 715 in the face of a torrent of racist abuse from all corners. But what did you learn through researching and interviewing folks for this piece? What did you learn that you did not know?
Oh man, there was a lot. one thing that I really was trying to, you know, focus on in the story was just try to look at just the influence that Henry had that went beyond just the home run. And when you look at Atlanta and you think about when the Braves moved from Milwaukee to Atlanta in 1966, the population of Atlanta, the metropolitan area, was close to 1 million people. And so, when the Braves moved there, that was the first major league pro sports team that they had in Atlanta. And now you look at it, almost 60 years later, Atlanta has now 6 million people.
Mm.
Like the city has completely grown. I mean, you've had the Braves move, then you had the Falcons move, become an expansion team. Then you had the Hawks move down there. So you had three professional sports franchises. Then you had the expansion of the airport with Maynard Jackson leading the way. And then you had, so much growth. And then all of it came from the fact that you had this professional sports team that made Atlanta a big league team. But it wasn't just that. It was a professional sports team in Atlanta, in the Deep South, with a black man as the best player. And what that did, you know, when you think about Jackie Robinson and what he did in terms of breaking the color barrier, you really got to look at what Henry Aaron did in terms of opening up the South for sports. And because, you know, there weren't too many professional sports teams south of the Mason-Dixon. And for him to go there, to thrive there, to perform there, to be excellent there, it's created a hunger for professional sports in the South, in the Deep South. And so now you've seen it, and you've seen stars go through there and perform there. And I think I was fortunate enough to talk to like Andrew Young and sort of have him confirm my thoughts that, you know, there's a direct line between the growth of Atlanta, the growth of sports in the South, and all this to Henry Aaron. And I don't think that part of his story is said enough, because we talk about him hitting a home run and breaking Babe Ruth's record, and that's marvelous, and dealing with adversity and dealing with hatred and vitriol and all these things that we know. But I don't think you really, I don't know if Henry's place in history is really mentioned, appreciated as much as it should be, because it wasn't just that he broke a home run record. It was just that he really opened doors for so many.
Agreed so much. Chuck, any questions?
Well, I want to answer your question. You had asked Michael, you know, what did he learn through the process? I'll tell you what I learned. I learned that Hank Aaron told Ted Turner, draft Dominique Wilkins by any means necessary. So that was a nugget I got. I'm going to let you know, the fourth pick was Bill Garnett. The fifth pick was LaSalle Thompson. So if Hank Aaron, Ted Turner took his advice and drafted Dominique Wilkins, that's a nice piece of a basketball legacy too. Did you know that ahead of time, Michael?
I had heard it, and I just needed Dominique to sort of confirm it for me. Talking to him was great too, because I learned a lot about him that, you know, or he confirmed a lot to me about his story that I wasn't aware of, about the fact that, you know, when he decided to leave North Carolina, the state of North Carolina, to go to University of Georgia, that there was a cross burning on the front of his house. Ooh. And his family sort of knew at that moment that they weren't going to be safe probably in a little small town in North Carolina much longer. And so they moved to Atlanta. He said that the University of Georgia basically snuck them out of the house in the middle of the night and took them to Georgia, and they moved to Atlanta. And that was sort of their safe haven. That was their refuge, moving to Atlanta, which is ironic. And I don't know if ironic is the right word, but it's it says a lot about Henry's influence, because this was 1979. This is 15 years. 1979, about 5 years after 7-15. But Atlanta all of a sudden becomes a safe haven for people in the Deep South when the team was moving to from Milwaukee. You know, Henry Aaron did not want to go, because he grew up in Mobile, Alabama. And he lived through segregation. You know, one of the stories that, you know, about the KKK would just parade through the neighborhood whenever they felt like it, to sort of just put fear in black families in that community. And so that's what he grew up with. And that was his impressions of the Deep South. And that's why he didn't want any part of it. But, you know, he comes there, and Atlanta always built itself as a city too busy to hate. And, you know, they really were just focused on business and the economy and trying to, you know, move forward in that respect. And one of the deals that they had to make to get the Braves was that they were going to have an integrated stadium, that they were going to have to make sure that they were welcoming to all people, because baseball didn't want to go there if it was going to be, you know, everybody segregated and blocked off. So they had to integrate their stadium, you know, for that to happen. And of course, Atlanta grows and everything. And just think about it. It was a place that Henry Aaron did not want to go to. And 13 years later, it's a safe haven for a family from North Carolina, black family from North Carolina. And it's kind of the story for the South in general, and especially when you look at Atlanta's growth. The reason why 6 million people are there now is because so many people, especially from the Northeast, you know, who are, you know, looking for, you know, more land, more space, but also from people in small towns in the Deep South who were just looking for opportunity, Atlanta provided that. And so when Atlanta became the big city in the South, it changed everything. And again, like I said, it all goes back to, to Henry Aaron, and I think that's pretty powerful.
What a legacy.
Yeah, and that's the other thing too. You asked me what I learned in doing this story. You talk about a legacy. We throw the word legacy around all the time. We talk about, oh, what's his legacy going to be, and what's her legacy going to be, what's their legacy going to be, and we measure all this stuff in what their statistics are, you know, or their championships, or you know, they average this many points, or they hit this many home runs, or they scored this many touchdowns, or whatever. That's their legacy, and I realize that we use that term way too loosely. Not everybody has a legacy. Not everybody has done enough to be put in the category of saying what your legacy is, because their influence and impact doesn't measure up to people who have a true legacy. So when you look at Henry Aaron, he has the numbers, and the numbers go on and on and on. You could just, you know, pound your head with just, oh, he had 3,771 hits. He had 755 home runs, and he has the most extra base hits of all time. He has the most bases, total bases of all time. He has this, da, 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 da. Every stat you can throw out there, but that's not his legacy. His legacy is one, being, you know, confident and secure enough in himself that when he was done playing baseball, that he could go into a front office role and being a scouting director for the franchise and sort of help them through an area when they wound up drafting successfully to where they could build a franchise, you know, that had Tom Glavine and Chipper Jones and Andrew Jones and all these guys that come up through this farm system to, you know, become this juggernaut that just ruled the National League, you know, East or West or whatever. they switched a bunch of times, but you know what I'm saying? They were in the division for however many years in a row, and the culture that he was able to establish just from a baseball perspective. Then we talk about just his influence on the city of Atlanta. I mean, you talk about what he's done for athletes in the South. You think about a Deion Sanders who played, you know, for the Braves and for the Falcons and really was able to become a cultural icon. Think about the currency of cool that came from playing in a black city for him, for Michael Vick, and all these things that come about. You know, that's a legacy. That's a legacy. Like, if you can leave that kind of legacy, then you've really had an impact, not just on the game, but on society. And I think that's when we need to really, you know, you talk about a legacy. Henry Aaron, you know, is untouchable when it comes to just that. I mean, we could talk about Barry Bonds surpassing him with home runs, but which record resonates? And why does it still resonate? It's not just because, you know, he had the most home runs. It's because of the way he carried himself. It's what he endured. It's what he did to ensure that when his playing career was over, that he was setting other people up for success. He was passing down, you know, he had scholarship programs for kids. He moved into business. He had car dealerships. He owned Popeye's Chickens. He owned Krispy Kreme donuts. So he was able to make so much money post-career, you know, so he had all these successes that came when his playing days were done, mainly because he was always secure in who he was and what he wanted to accomplish. And a lot of times when you see athletes and they die, or not die, their athletic career dies and they retire, there's a difficult transition into civilian life and sort of transitioning into just whatever they're going to be. And like, who am I now that I can no longer, that I'm no longer, you know, surrounded or dominated by a ball? Like, what am I now? And he didn't have that issue. And you know, so there's a lot that I learned. There's a lot that I couldn't get into the story, so much that I couldn't get into the story. I think one thing that stood out to me, and I guess it's something I probably should have known, but it didn't really register, but he was just 5'9". You know, he's a 5'9 guy. Like, it's not like he was some powerful, like Aaron Judge type, you know, who's just going up there and just cranking out home runs. His power came from just his wrist, and he had such an amazing read on pitchers. He could predict what they were going to throw. He could anticipate what they were going to do with each count. He studied them hard. And I remember talking to Dusty Baker a little bit about him. One thing that he did, This is something I couldn't really get into, and I'm just saying this now, expressing this now to you guys for the first time. Usually, when you get to baseball, and I think Howard Bryant mentioned it in his great book, The Last Hero. But usually in baseball, between the ages of 35, once you turn 35, you go off a cliff if you haven't already, you know, because your athleticism tails off. You don't really have the ability and the talent to perform at that level anymore. But from 35 to 39, he defied all reason and logic in terms of his power and productivity. So at a time when like all of his peers and colleagues were just fading off, Willie Mays and all these guys, he was still relevant. He was still hitting home runs. He was still justifiably earning all-star trips, not just off of his name, but off of his production. And it got me thinking that, you know, we always talk about LeBron and, you know, we compare him to MJ, right? We talk about little LeBron, MJ, you know, who's the GOAT, da-da-da-da. And I think that a lot, when you look at just the statistics, Henry Aaron and LeBron got a lot in common. You know, LeBron has like, he's an all-time leading scorer. He's got all these, you know, top five, whatever, assists. He's, you know, he's going to be, you know, 10,000 rebounds before it's all said and done if he hadn't already have it. So he's going to have all of these accumulated statistics, and he's going to have incredible, incredible productivity between the ages of 35 and 39, which we've never seen before. So all this time we talk about, we compare guys, we compare GOATs, we compare, you know, greats, but we never really look at, you know, other sports and how they kind of translate. And when I think about Henry Aaron and the way we look at him now statistically and all his contributions, I think we'll have a greater appreciation for LeBron when he's done because of what he's been able to do between those ages when usually athletes fall off a cliff between 35 and 40, and he's still productive, and he's going to have these amazing statistics that you can't deny just how great he was during that era. So I think a lot of times we get caught up in comparing LeBron to MJ, but really the comparison is Henry Aaron.
Wow. You know, at first, I got some breaking news. O.J. Simpson died.
What?
Yeah, that just happened. Not prepared to talk about it in the slightest, especially given how much Henry Aaron was overshadowed at times in his career. We're not going to overshadow him right now. Let me ask you this, Michael. I know, breaking news, have to report it. Yeah, but let me ask, yeah, as we take a second with that, one more question for you, Michael, before you go. You've been so generous with your time. Everyone talks about Atlanta being the city too busy to hate, and yet it was also a fulcrum of civil rights struggle and the black freedom struggle. And Henry Aaron certainly faced his hate as he was approaching that record. How much did Henry Aaron mean to people in the movement during the late 60s and early 70s, given that he was in Atlanta, given that he was approaching this record that was so associated with whiteness, ironic given Babe Ruth's perhaps background, but we'll move on from that. What do you think Henry Aaron meant to people just who were putting it on the line in the streets of Atlanta and beyond?
Yeah, that's one thing that, you know, Andrew Young has always, you know, spoken about. You know, he was, you know, a part of the movement. He wound up becoming the mayor of Atlanta at one stretch. And every important person in during that era, you know, Joseph Lowery, Martin Luther King, Andrew Young, Benjamin Mays, basically every street that's in Atlanta of anybody of prominence, he was friends with, and he was somebody who always felt that he was definitely somebody who supported the movement. He may not have been as confident in expressing his views. He may not have felt he was as eloquent as or an orator, obviously, of some of his friends who were great communicators. But I remember reading Andrew Young say that they basically just told him, "Man, you just swing that bat, and you express yourself through that. We'll handle the rest. You take care of what you need to do on the field, because that is doing enough to break down barriers and perceptions, because there are going to be white kids growing up in Georgia who are going to see a black man as their hero, who are going to look at and idolize a black man and want to grow up to be like a black man one day, which is breaking down walls that we can't break down, because we want to show people that, yeah, we're just as good, but we also can be the standard bearer for greatness." And I think that's what Henry Aaron was able to do, because, you know, he went to Atlanta, but he didn't have to be outspoken. He didn't have to go out there and, you know, protest or do anything. You know, all he had to do was just focus on his part of end of the bargain. And he was friends with all these other guys. But then once his playing career was over, you never heard him, you know, back down from his thoughts. You know, I think one thing that that stood out too is that he was able to see a Jackie Robinson and how the end came for him a lot quicker than it should have. You know, he was so run down and worn down from the experience of playing in Major League Baseball, the frustration of not seeing black people progress the way he had hoped in American society, but also in baseball. And there were a lot of things that could have broken Henry because he saw the exact same things, but he also learned from Jackie that there are certain fights that he couldn't make, he couldn't take on because it was too much. And he was fortunate that he was in a city, in a place where he didn't have to feel the burden that he had to carry on so much weight. And I think that's probably the best part for him, is that he was in Atlanta, where there was a progressive, you know, and there were influential black people, you know, who had, you know, the ability to make change in that community without him coming out front and saying this needs to change and we need to do this, we need to fix that. He had that pressure removed from him. And so all he had to do was just be a great and a tremendous role model. And that's the way he was able to do his part. And once his playing career is over, then he was able to be more outspoken and do things. I think his last gesture was to get the COVID vaccine and try to encourage people in the community, you know, to take care of themselves and protect themselves from this virus. And he did it publicly. And it was a bold statement. And he obviously passed shortly thereafter. But the fact that even until the end, he understood his purpose was beyond just being the home run king. It was also, he had to be an example for everyone. He was just an admirable human being. Everyone loved and respected him. And I think Marquise Grissom said it best, you know, everyone won't remember your numbers, but they will remember you. And when it comes to Henry Aaron, we will always remember him, even if we don't remember all the numbers.
Wow. Throwing down with Marquise Grissom. That's
fellow Rattler, you know, I had to, you know, give props to fellow Rattler.
Exactly. Yo, for everybody out there listening, my Twitter feed or whatever you want to call it is at Edge of Sports. I'm going to put out right now Michael Lee's article, Henry Allen Aaron's Legacy Lives On 50 Years After the Home Run Record. If you haven't read it, it's an incredible piece of journalism. Everybody needs to read it. That's your Collision radio program homework assignment, even though it won't feel like homework. It's too good for that. Michael Lee, thank you so much for joining us here. On Collision.
Thank you. I want to give an extra thank you, DZ, because you know how big a Jim Caldwell advocate I am. And Michael Lee wrote an incredible article, The NFL Loves Quarterback Whispers, Why Doesn't It Love Jim Caldwell? We've had that discussion so many times, so I thank you for putting that important piece together. Unfortunately, it didn't help him get hired, but nonetheless, hold people accountable. So thanks for that, too.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right, now enter the OJ multiverse, sir.
I'm about to check out what's going on now in the world, but thanks for having me on. It's always great catching up with you guys.
All right, great to talk to you, Michael. What a writer, Michael Lee. My goodness.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks.
What a great writer. And, you know, while you were talking, DZ, I looked up the late career of Hank Aaron the last 5 years from age 35 to 39, and it's pretty astounding. Even though he only averaged 137 games, he averaged 41 homers, 101 RBIs, 300 batting average, and 1,000 OPS. So this is pretty incredible for those years. And if you extrapolate to 162 games, it's 48 homers from age 35 to 39. Pretty incredible stuff.
It is incredible. And his model of consistency as a player, too. Like, he never hit 50 home runs in a season. His career high was 47, and yet he hit 755 home runs. It's really a remarkable statement about him. Well, we're just about running out of time. You know, I want to give one last shout-out, if I could, Chuck, to Joyce Ladner.
Sure.
And love to Sister Dory, both of them. You know, Michael Lee was talking about the question of legacy. Ooh. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Ladner legacy is so towering, the likes of which that we all benefit on the most blistering and sunny days of being able to sit in its shadow. Thank you so much to them. Thank you, Michael Lee. Chuck, any last comments?
Just Dory Ladner, I just won't forget. We all went to lunch with her, and we just sat there and listened and absorbed. She really wanted to give that wisdom. It wasn't, I'm a civil rights icon, anything like that. It was, how do we continue this fight? It was, how do we continue fighting, not resting on laurels, which she should have done. And I believe she was like that to the day she died.
Amazing. Yo, everybody out there listening, thank you so much for joining us here on The Collision, where we try to be your voice at the intersection of sports and politics. For everybody out there listening, please stay frosty. We are out of here. Peace.
KRX and I'm on the mic and premieres on the breaks.
ADASI, the African Diaspora Ancestral Commemoration Institute, will host a free DC Emancipation Day program entitled Black Liberation Struggles in Global Africa. Then and now, on Tuesday, April 16th, 2024, from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. at Enlightened Inc., 1205 Marion Barry Avenue Southeast, the program will commemorate the enslaved ancestors who crossed over the Old Navy Yard Bridge, the precursor to the 11th Street Bridge in Southeast, from enslavement in Maryland to freedom in the District of Columbia after the abolition of slavery in D.C. on April 16, 1862. It will feature esteemed historian C.R. Gibbs and many others. For information, please call 202-505-2896 or visit adasiancestors.org. That's A-D-A-C-I ancestors.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Dori Ladner was a courageous civil rights activist. Her legacy lives on every time we choose to confront injustice. Dori Ladner's funeral will be held this Saturday, April 13th, at Shiloh Baptist Church, 1500 9th Street, Northwest, D.C., at 11 a.m. All are welcome to come and bid farewell to this icon of the civil rights movement. WPFW extends condolences to the family of Dori Ladner.
The search process for WPFW's next general manager is underway. Successful management searches begin by having conversations with stakeholders to clarify and document expectations for future management. Therefore, WPFW's local station board is inviting all stakeholders to participate in our online survey. To complete the survey, please click the link on WPFW's website. Because we need your input, the deadline for the survey has been extended to Friday, April 12, 2024. Thank you.
Born of Haitian descent, Jerry Paris, WPFW's general manager, is moving on to retirement. On April 14th, from 3 p.m. until 7 p.m., we will celebrate his departure at the VIP Room, 6201 3rd Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., with Island Flair, steel drums, a DJ, and food from the islands. That's April 14th from 3 p.m. until 7 p.m. For more information and tickets, call 202-368-4081 or visit Eventbrite and search for Jerry Paris Retirement. Seating is limited.
WPFW is looking for a new place to hang our hats and microphones. And we're betting that members of WPFW's In the Know listening community, folks like you, may know of spaces where we might make our new home. Have you walked past or know of a cool space that appears to be for lease? Hit us to it. Know of something that's not yet on the market? We're all ears. Your station for jazz and justice requires 2,200 square feet of space in Washington, D.C. or immediate environs. Metro accessible with nearby parking. We value your suggestions and observations as we embark on this vital mission. Email your tips to wpfw.com. lsb.relocation@gmail.com. And thanks for all you do to nourish and sustain WPFW, building a better world one broadcast at a time.
You'd be so nice to come home to. You'd be so nice. Bye.
Welcome to The Collision.
The Collision, where sports and politics smash, Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
No social justice issue or movement can escape the spotlight of the Latino Media Collective. The Latino Media Collective delivers consequential coverage from the biggest countries in South America.